York City made it imperative that the English government maintain control of the situation there. Once again, the colonists did not object to the principle of supporting troops or even quartering them, but instead challenged the authority of Parliament to mandate such support. A series of written arguments by Charles C. Pinckney and Edward Rutledge, both of South Carolina, Daniel Delaney of Maryland, and John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, provided a comprehensive critique of the new acts based on English law and traditions. Dickinson's Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania reached wide audiences and influenced groups outside the seaboard elites. British officials were stunned to find that, rather than abandoning New York, other colonies expressed their support for their sister colony. No more important ally of New York could exist than Massachusetts, where Sam Adams and a group of vocal followers organized resistance in the Massachusetts Assembly. Letters went out from the Assembly to other colonies urging them to resist the new taxes and to boycott British goods until the measures were lifted. The missive might have died except for further meddling by the British Secretary of State, who warned that Parliament would dissolve any colonial assemblies that endorsed the position of the Massachusetts Assembly. All of the colonies promptly supported the Massachusetts letter, even Pennsylvania, which had refused to support the earlier correspondence. Whereas New York had borne the brunt of England's initial policies, Boston rapidly became the center of revolutionary ferment and British repercussions. Britain transferred 4 regiments of troops from Halifax to Boston, stationing them directly within the city in a defiant symbol of occupation. Bostonians reacted angrily to the presence of redcoats and lobsterbacks, whereas the soldiers treated citizens rudely and competed with them for off-hour work. Tensions heightened until, on March 5, 1770, a street fight erupted between a mob of 70 or so workers at a shipyard and a handful of British sentries. Snowballs gave way to gunfire from the surrounded and terrified soldiers, leaving 5 colonists dead and 6 wounded. American polemicists, especially Sam Adams, lost no time in labeling this the Boston Massacre. Local juries thought otherwise, finding the soldiers guilty of relatively minor offenses, not murder, thanks in part to the skillful legal defense of John Adams. If Britain had her way, the issue would have died a quiet death. Unfortunately for Parliament, the other Adams, John's distant cousin Sam, played a crucial role in fanning the fires of independence. He had found his calling as a writer after failing in private business and holding a string of lackluster jobs in government. Adams enlisted other gifted writers who published under pen names to produce a series of broadsides like those produced by Dickinson and the pre-massacre pamphleteers. But Adams was the critical voice disturbing the lull that Britain sought, publishing more than 40 articles in a 2-year period after the massacre. He established the Lockean basis for the rights demanded by Americans and did so in a clear and concise style that appealed to less educated citizens. In November 1772, at a town meeting in Boston, Adams successfully pressed for the creation of a committee of correspondence to link writers in different colonies. These actions demonstrated the growing power of the presses, churning out a torrent of tracts and editorials critical of England's rule. The British were helpless to stop these publishers. Certainly, court actions were no longer effective. Following the example of Massachusetts, Virginia's House of Burgesses, led by Jefferson, Henry, and Richard Henry Lee, forged resolutions that provided for the appointment of permanent committees of correspondence in every colony, referred to by one governor as black-hearted fellows whom one would not wish to meet in the dark. Committees constituted an unelected but nevertheless representative body of those with grievances against the British Empire. Josiah Quincy and Tom Paine joined this revolutionary vanguard, steadfastly and fearlessly demanding that England grant the colonists the rights of Englishmen. Adams always remained on the cutting edge, however, and was among the first advocating outright separation from the mother country. Tied to each other by the committees of correspondence, colonies further cemented their unity, attitudes, and common interests, or, put another way, became increasingly American. By 1775, a wide spectrum of clubs, organizations, and merchants' groups supported the committees of correspondence. Among them, the Sons of Liberty, the Sons of Neptune, the Philadelphia Patriotic Society, and others provided the organizational framework necessary for revolution. The 42 American newspapers and a flood of pamphlets and letters gave voice to the revolution. Churches echoed the messages of liberty, reinforcing the goal of tinging the minds of the people and impregnating them with the sentiments of liberty. News, such as the colonists' burning in 1772 of the Gaspee, a British schooner that ran aground in Rhode Island during an ill-fated mission to enforce revenue laws, circulated quickly throughout the colonies, even before the correspondence committees were fully in place, lending further evidence to the growing public perception that the imperial system was oppressive. Thus, the colonial dissatisfaction incorporated the yeoman farmer and the land speculator, the intellectual and the merchant, the parson and the politician, all well-organized and impressively led. Boston emerged as the focal hub of discontent, and the brewing rebellion had able leaders in the Adamses and a dedicated coppersmith named Paul Revere. Lacking the education of John Adams or the rhetorical skill of Sam, Revere brought his own considerable talents to the table of resistance. A man plugged into all the Boston social networks, as were few other men, Revere was known by virtually all. One study found that besides the Sons of Liberty, there were six other main revolutionary groups in Boston. Of the 255 leading males in Boston society, only two were in as many as five of these groups, Joseph Warren and Paul Revere. Revere percolated the revolutionary brew, keeping all parties informed and laying down a vital structure of associations that he would literally call upon at a moment's notice in 1775. Only through his dedicated planning was an effective resistance later possible. Boston's Tea Party. Under such circumstances, all that was needed to ignite the revolutionary explosion was a spark, which the British conveniently provided with the passage of the Tea Act in 1773. Tea played a crucial role in the life of typical American colonists. The water in North America remained undrinkable in many locations, far more polluted with disease and bacteria than modern drinking water. Thus, tea, which was boiled, made up the staple non-alcoholic drink. The East India Company had managed to run itself into near bankruptcy despite a monopoly status within the empire. Its tea sent to America had to go through England first, where it was lightly taxed. But smugglers dealing directly with Dutch suppliers shipped directly to the colonies and provided the same tea at much lower prices. The Tea Act withdrew all duties on tea re-exported to America, although it left in place an earlier light tax from the Townshend Act. Britain naturally anticipated that colonists would rejoice at the lower above-board prices, despite the imposition of a small tax. In fact, not only did average colonists benefit from drinking the cheap smuggled tea, but a number of merchant politicians, including John Hancock of Massachusetts, also regularly smuggled tea and stood to be wiped out by enforcement of the new act. Even those merchants who legitimately dealt in tea faced financial ruin under the monopoly privileges of the East India Company. Large public meetings produced a strategy toward the tea, which involved not only boycotting the product, but also preventing the tea from even being unloaded in America. Tea agents were labeled enemies of the people, and guards kept the tea on the ships. Three ships carrying substantial amounts of tea reached Boston Harbor in December 1773, whereupon a crowd of more than 7,000, led by Sam Adams, greeted them. Members of the crowd, the Sons of Liberty dressed as Mohawk Indians, boarded the vessels and threw 342 chests of tea overboard, while the local authorities condoned the action. The Mohawks took care not to harm any members of the crews, and thus the Tea Party was later cited by Mahatma Gandhi as an example of an effective protest. The British admiral in charge of the Boston Harbor Squadron watched the entire affair from his flagship deck. In Delaware, 9 days later, a similar event occurred when another 700 chests of tea sank to the bottom of the sea, although without a Sam Adams to propagandize the event, no one remembers the Delaware Tea Party. New Yorkers forced cargo to remain on its ships in their port. When some tea was finally unloaded in Charleston, it couldn't be sold for 3 years. Throughout, only a few eminent colonists, including Ben Franklin and John Adams, condemned the boardings, and for the most part, Americans supported the Mohawks. But even John Adams agreed that if a people rise up, they should do something to be remembered, something notable and striking. Notable and striking the Tea Party was. Britain, of course, could not permit such outright criminality. The king singled out Boston as the chief culprit in the uprising, and in 1774, Parliament passed what Americans labeled the Intolerable or Coercive Acts. The acts had several major components. First, Britain closed Boston Harbor until someone paid for the tea destroyed there. Second, the Charter of Massachusetts was annulled, and the governor's council was to be appointed by the king, signaling to the citizens a revocation of their rights as Englishmen. Third, a new quartering act was passed, requiring homeowners and innkeepers to board soldiers at only a fraction of the real cost of boarding them. Fourth, British soldiers and officials accused of committing crimes were to be returned to England for trial. Fifth, the Quebec Act transferred lands between the Ohio and Mississippi rivers to the province of Quebec and guaranteed religious freedom to Catholics. New Englanders not only viewed the Quebec Act as theft of lands intended for American colonial settlement, they also feared the presence of more Catholics on the frontier. John Adams, for one, was terrified of the potential for a re-Catholicization of America. Anti-papism was endemic in New England, where political propagandists fulminated against this new encroachment of the Roman Antichrist. Southerners had their own reasons for supporting independence. Tidewater planters found themselves under an increasing debt burden, made worse by British taxes and unfair competition from monopolies. Lord Dunmore's anti-slavery initiatives frightened the Virginia planters as much as the Catholic priests terrified New Englanders. At a time when slavery continued to exert mounting tensions on Whig American notions of liberty and property, the fact that the Southerners could unite with their brethren farther north had to concern England. Equally as fascinating as the alliance between the slave colonies and the non-slave-holding colonies was the willingness of men of the cloth to join hardened frontiersmen in taking up arms against England. John Witherspoon, a New Jersey cleric who supported the resistance, warned that there is not a single instance in history in which civil liberty was lost and religious liberty preserved entire. Virginia parson Peter Muhlenberg was another such cleric-turned-armed patriot, upon whom the character Reverend Oliver in the film The Patriot was based. According to a biography of Muhlenberg done years later by his nephew, the parson supposedly took off his cleric's garments and grabbed a rifle while quoting scripture. Massachusetts attorney and New Jersey minister, Virginia farmer and Pennsylvania sage, South Carolina slaveholder and New York politician all found themselves increasingly aligned against the English monarch. Whatever differences they had, their similarities surpassed them. Significantly, the colonists' complaints encompassed all oppression. Colonists didn't confine their thoughts about oppression simply to British power. They generalized the lesson in terms of human nature and politics at large. Something even bigger than resistance to the King of England knitted together the American colonists in a fabric of freedom. On the eve of the Revolution, there were far more united for a wide variety of motivations than the British authorities ever suspected. Each region had its own reason for associating with the others to force a peaceful conclusion to the crisis when the intolerable acts upped the ante for all the players. If British authorities truly hoped to isolate Boston, they realized quickly how badly they had misjudged the situation. The king, having originally urged that the tea duty be repealed, reluctantly concluded that the colonists must either triumph or submit, confirming Woodrow Wilson's estimate that George III had too small a mind to rule an empire. Intending to force compliance, Britain dispatched General Thomas Gage and 4 regiments of redcoats to Massachusetts. Gage was a tragic figure. He proved unrelenting in his enforcement methods, generating still more colonial opposition, yet he operated within a code of decency, moderation, liberty, and the rule of law. This sense of fairness and commitment to the law posed a disturbing dilemma for his objective of crushing the rebellion. The first united resistance by the colonies occurred in September 1774, when delegates to a Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia in response to calls from both Massachusetts and Virginia. Delegates from every colony except Georgia arrived, displaying the widespread sympathy in the colonies for the position of Boston. Present were both Adamses from Massachusetts and Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, and the indispensable man, George Washington, representing Virginia. Congress received a series of resolves from Suffolk County, Massachusetts, carried to the meeting by Paul Revere. These Suffolk resolves declared loyalty to the king, but scorned the hand which would ransack our pockets and the dagger to our bosoms. When Congress endorsed the Suffolk resolves, Lord Dartmouth, British Secretary of State, warned, "The American people are generally ripe for the execution of any plan the Congress advises, should it be war itself." King George put it much more succinctly, stating, "The die is cast." No act of Congress was more symbolic of how far the colonies had come toward independence than the Galloway Plan of Union. Offered by Joseph Galloway of Pennsylvania, the plan proposed the establishment of a federal union for the colonies in America, headed by a president general appointed by the king and advised by a grand council whose representatives would be chosen by the colonial assemblies. Presented roughly 3 weeks after the Suffolk resolves, the Galloway plan was rejected only after a long debate, with the final vote taken only in the absence of many of the advocates. Still, it showed that the colonies already had started to consider their own semi-autonomous government. Revolutionary ideas. In October 1774, the First Continental Congress adopted a Declaration of Rights and Grievances, 12 resolutions stating the rights of the colonists in the empire. Among the resolutions was a statement of the rights of Americans to life, liberty, and property, secured by the principles of the British Constitution, the unchanging laws of nature, and the colonial charters. Where had the colonists gotten such concepts? 3 major Enlightenment thinkers deeply affected the concepts of liberty and government held by the majority of the American revolutionary leaders. Certainly all writers had not read the same European authors, and certainly all were affected by different ideas to different degrees, often depending on the relationship any given writer placed on the role of God in human affairs. Nevertheless, the overall molding of America's revolution in the ideological sense can be traced to the theories of Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and the Baron Charles de Montesquieu. Hobbes, an English writer of the mid-1600s, was a supporter of the monarchy. In The Leviathan, 1661, Hobbes described an ancient, even prehistoric, state of nature in which man was at war with every other man, and life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. To escape such circumstances, man created the civil state, or government, in which people gave up all other rights to receive protection from the monarch. As long as government delivered its subjects from the fear of violent death, it could place on them any other burden or infringe on any other rights. From Hobbes, therefore, the revolutionary writers took the concept of right to life that infused virtually all the subsequent writings. Another Englishman, John Locke, writing under much different circumstances, agreed with Hobbes that a state of nature once existed, but differed totally as to its character. Locke's state of nature was beautiful and virtually sinless, but somehow man had fallen out of that state, and to protect his rights entered into a social compact or a civil government. It is significant that both Hobbes and Locke departed substantially from the classical Greek and Roman thinkers, including Aristotle, who held that government was a natural condition of humans. Both Hobbes and Locke saw government as artificial, created by man rather than natural to man. Locke, writing in his Second Treatise on Government, described the most desirable government as one that protected human life, liberty, and estate. Therefore, government should be limited. It should only be strong enough to protect these three inalienable rights. From Locke, then, the revolutionary writers took the phrase right to liberty as well as to property. Hobbes and Locke, therefore, had laid the groundwork for the Declaration of Rights and Grievances, and later the Declaration of Independence, which contained such principles as limitations on the rights of the government and rule by consent of the governed. All that remained was to determine how best to guarantee those rights, an issue considered by a French aristocrat, Charles de Montesquieu, in The Spirit of the Laws, drawing largely on his admiration for the British constitutional system. Montesquieu suggested dividing the authority of the government among various branches with different functions, providing a blueprint for the future government of the United States. While some of the creme de la creme in American political circles read or studied Locke or Hobbes, most Virginia and Massachusetts lawyers were common attorneys, dealing with property and personal rights in society, not in abstract theory. Still, ideas do seep through. Thanks to the American love of newspapers, pamphlets, oral debate, and informal political discussion, by 1775, many of the revolutionaries, whether they realized it or not, sounded like John Locke and his disciples. Locke and his fellow Whigs, who overthrew James II, had spawned a second generation of propagandists in the 1700s. Considered extremists and coffeehouse radicals in post-Glorious Revolution England, Whig writers John Trenchard, Lord Bolingbroke, and Thomas Gordon warned of the tyrannical potential of the Hanoverian kings, George I and George II. Influential Americans read and circulated these radical Whig writings. A quantified study of colonial libraries, for example, shows that a high number of Whig pamphlets and newspaper essays had made their way onto American bookshelves. Moreover, the Whig ideas proliferated beyond their original form in hundreds of colonial pamphlets, editorials, essays, letters, and oral traditions and informal political discussions. It goes without saying, of course, that most of these men were steeped in the traditions and teachings of Christianity. Almost half the signers of the Declaration of Independence had some form of seminary training or degree. John Adams, certainly and somewhat derogatorily viewed by his contemporaries as the most pious of the early revolutionaries, claimed that the revolution connected in one indissoluble bond the principles of civil government with the principles of Christianity. John's cousin Sam cited passage of the Declaration as the day that the colonists restored the sovereign to whom alone men ought to be obedient. John Witherspoon's influence before and after the adoption of the Declaration was obvious, but other well-known patriots, such as John Hancock, did not hesitate to echo the reliance on God. In short, any reading of the American Revolution from a purely secular viewpoint ignores a fundamentally Christian component of the revolutionary ideology. Contrary to the oft-purported notion that most of the founders were deists, the majority were believers in the common understanding of the term. Perhaps only Jefferson had a truly deistic theology, although even that is up for grabs. He attended church regularly and, as a Freemason, was required to state his belief in God. Franklin, while skeptical of the divinity of Jesus, absolutely held to the doctrine of a providential God who played a part in men's lives and to whom one prayed. Washington's faith was complex, but not deistic in any sense. He referred to God by at least 104 different names, a trait shared by John Adams, who would later draft the Massachusetts State Constitution and invoked terms such as Supreme Being, Great Creator, Preserver of the Universe, and of course, God. Washington's 1752 handwritten manuscript book contained a prayer ending with, "I humbly beseech thee to be merciful to me in the free pardon of my sins for the sake of thy dear Son and only Savior Jesus Christ, who came to call not the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Thou gavest thy Son to die for me." That leaves little room to claim that Washington did not claim Jesus as his personal Savior. One can understand how scholars could be misled on the importance of religion in daily life and political thought. Data on religious adherence suggests that on the eve of the Revolution, perhaps no more than 20% of the American colonial population was churched. That certainly did not mean they were not God-fearing or religious. It did reflect, however, a dominance of the three major denominations, Congregationalist, Presbyterian, and Episcopal, that suddenly found themselves challenged by rapidly rising new groups, the Baptists and Methodists. Competition from the new denominations proved so intense that clergy in Connecticut appealed to the assembly for protection against the intrusions of itinerant ministers. But self-preservation also induced church authorities to lie about the presence of other denominations, claiming that places abounding in Baptists or Methodists were unchurched. In short, while church membership rolls may have indicated low levels of religiosity, a thriving competition for the religious market had appeared, and contrary to the claims of many that the late 1700s constituted an ebb in American Christianity, God was alive and well, and fairly popular. Lexington, Concord, and War. Escalating the potential for conflict still further, the people of Massachusetts established a revolutionary government and raised an army of soldiers known as Minutemen, able to fight on a minute's notice. While all able-bodied males from 16 to 60, including congregational ministers, came out for muster and drill, each militia company selected and paid additional money to a subgroup, 20 to 25% of its number, to hold themselves in readiness at a minute's warning, complete with arms and ammunition, that is to say a good and sufficient firelock, bayonet, 30 rounds of powder and ball, pouch, and knapsack. About this, they were resolute. Citizens in Lexington taxed themselves a substantial amount for the purpose of mounting the cannon, ammunition, and for carriage and harness for burying the dead. It is noteworthy that the colonists had already levied money for burying the dead, revealing that they approached the coming conflict with stark realism. The nearly universal ownership and use of firearms as a fact bears repetition here to address a recent stream of scholarship that purports to show that Americans did not widely possess or use firearms. Some critics of the so-called gun culture have attempted to show through probate records that few guns were listed among household belongings bequeathed to heirs. Thus, guns were not numerous, nor hunting and gun ownership widespread. But in fact, guns were so prevalent that citizens did not need to list them specifically. On the eve of the Revolution, Massachusetts citizens were well-armed, and not only with small weapons, but collectively with artillery. General Thomas Gage, the commander of the British garrison in Boston, faced two equally unpleasant alternatives. He could follow the advice of younger officers, such as Major John Pitcairn, to confront the Minutemen immediately before their numbers grew, or he could take a more conservative approach by awaiting reinforcements, while recognizing that the enemy itself would be reinforced and better equipped with each passing day. Gage finally moved when he learned that the Minutemen had a large store of munitions at Concord, a small village 18 miles from Boston. He issued orders to arrest the political firebrands and rhetoricians Samuel Adams and John Hancock, who were reported in the Lexington area, and to secure the cannons from the colonists. Gage therefore sought to kill two birds with one stone when, on the night of April 18, 1775, he sent 1,000 soldiers from Boston to march up the road via Lexington to Concord. If he could surprise the colonials and could capture Adams, Hancock, and the supplies quietly, the situation might be defused. But the Patriots learned of British intentions and signaled the British route with lanterns from the Old North Church, whereupon two riders, Paul Revere and William Dawes, left Boston by different routes to rouse the Minutemen. Calling, "To arms, to arms," Revere and Dawes' daring mission successfully alerted the Patriots at Lexington, at no small cost to Revere, who fell from his horse after warning Hancock and Adams and was captured at one point, but then escaped. Dawes did not have the good fortune to appear in Longfellow's famous poem, The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, and his contributions are less appreciated. But his mission was more narrowly defined. Once alerted, the Minutemen drew up in skirmish lines on the Lexington Town Common when the British appeared. One of the British commanders shouted, "Disperse, you damned rebels! Damn you, disperse!" Both sides presented their arms. The "shot heard round the world" rang out, although historians still debate who fired first because it was so dark, and the British achieved their first victory of the war. 8 Minutemen had been killed and 10 wounded when the Patriots yielded the field. Major Pitcairn's force continued to Concord, where it destroyed the supplies and started to return to Boston. By that time, Minutemen in the surrounding countryside had turned out, attacking the British in skirmishing positions along the road. Pitcairn sent for reinforcements, but he knew that his troops had to fight their way back to Boston on their own. A hail of colonial musket balls fell on the British, who deployed in battle formation only to see their enemy fade into the trees and hills. American Minutemen were indeed sharpshooters, weaned on years of hunting, but firing at an enemy who moved and shot back was much different than shooting a bear. Of the more than 5,000 shots fired at the Redcoats that day, fewer than 300 hit their targets, leaving the British with just over 270 casualties. Nevertheless, the perception by the British and colonists alike quickly spread that the most powerful army in the world had been routed by patriots lacking artillery, cavalry, or even a general. At the centennial celebration at Concord on April 19, 1875, Ralph Waldo Emerson described the skirmish as a thunderbolt which falls on an inch of ground, but the light of it fills the horizon. News crackled like electricity throughout the American colonies, sparking patriotic fervor unseen up to that time. Thousands of armed American colonists traveled to Boston, where they surrounded Gage and pinned him in the town. Franklin worked under no illusions that the war would be quick. To an English acquaintance, he wrote, "You will have heard, before this reaches you, of the commencement of a civil war. The end of it, perhaps neither myself nor you, who are much younger, may live to see." For the third time in less than a century, the opponents of these American militiamen had grossly underestimated them. Though slow to act, these New Englanders became the most implacable of foes, as David Fisher observed. Their many enemies who lived by a warrior ethic always underestimated them, as a long parade of Indian braves, French aristocrats, British regulars, Southern planters, German fascists, Japanese militarists, Marxist ideologues, and Arab adventurers have invariably discovered to their heavy cost. As the conflict dragged on, however, New Englanders, with the exception of John Glover's Maine Volunteers, did not live up to their early successes, while the southern and middle colonies carried the war. Resolutions endorsing war came from all quarters, with the most outspoken coming from North Carolina. They coincided with the meeting of the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia, beginning on May 10, 1775. All the colonies sent representatives, most of whom had no sanction from the colonial governors, leaving their selection to the more radical elements in the colonies. Accordingly, men such as John Adams attended the convention with the intent of declaring independence from England. Some conservatives, such as John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, struggled to avoid a complete break with the mother country, but ultimately the sentiments for independence had grown too strong. As the great American historian George Bancroft observed, "A new principle, far mightier than the church and state of the Middle Ages, was forcing itself into power. It was the office of America to substitute for hereditary privilege the natural equality of man. For the irresponsible authority of a sovereign, a dependent government emanating from a concord of opinion." Congress assumed authority over the ragtag army that opposed Gage and appointed George Washington as the commander-in-chief. Washington accepted reluctantly, telling his wife Martha, "I have used every endeavor in power to avoid the command, not only from my unwillingness to part with you, but from a consciousness of its being a trust too great for my capacity." Nor did Washington have the same intense desire for separation from England that burned within Samuel Adams or Patrick Henry. His officers still toasted the health of King George as late as January 1776. The indispensable man. Washington earned respect in many quarters because he seldom beat his own drum. His modesty and self-deprecation were refreshing and commendable, and certainly he had real reasons for doubting his qualifications to lead the colonial forces, his defeat at Fort Necessity, for example. But in virtually all respects, Washington was the perfect selection for the job, the indispensable man of the revolution, as biographer James Flexner called him. Towering by colonial standards at 6 feet 4 inches, Washington physically dominated a scene, with his stature enhanced by his background as a wealthy plantation owner of more than modest means, and his reputation as the greatest horseman in Virginia. Capable of extracting immense loyalty, especially from most of his officers, though there were exceptions, Washington also inspired his soldiers with exceptional self-control, personal honor, and high morals. While appearing stiff or distant to strangers, Washington reserved his emotions for his intimate friends, comrades in arms, and his wife. For such a popular general, however, Washington held his troops in low regard. He demanded clear distinctions in rank among his officers and did not tolerate sloth or disobedience. Any soldier who went AWOL, absent without leave, faced 100 to 300 lashes, whereas a soldier deserting a post in combat was subject to the death penalty. He referred to Yankee recruits as dirty and nasty people and derided the dirty mercenary spirit of his men. On occasion, Washington placed sharpshooters behind his army as a disincentive to break ranks. Despite his skill, Washington won few open-field battles with the British and suffered several heartbreaking defeats. Nevertheless, in the face of such losses, of such constant shortages of supplies and money, and of less than unified support from the colonists themselves, Washington kept his army together, ignoring some of the undisciplined antics of Daniel Morgan's Virginians and the Pennsylvania riflemen, and skillfully avoided any single crushing military debacle that would have doomed the Revolution. What he lacked in tactics, he made up for in strategy, realizing that with each passing day, the British positions became more untenable. Other colonial leaders were more intellectually astute, perhaps, and certainly many others exhibited flashier oratorical skills. But more than any other individual of the day, Washington combined a sound mind with practical soldiers' skills, a faith in the future melded with an impeccable character, and the ability to wield power effectively without aspiring to gain from it personally. He accepted no pay while commander-in-chief, although he kept track of expenses owed him. In all likelihood, no other single person possessed these essential qualities needed to hold the revolutionary armies together. It is not too much to suggest that if George Washington was killed at Princeton while riding between the lines, there would be no independent America today. He personified a spirit among militia and regular soldiers alike that Americans possessed superior fighting capabilities to the British military. They pressed their claim to native courage extravagantly because they went to war reluctantly. Americans sincerely believed they had an innate courage that would offset British advantages in discipline. "Gunpowder and lead shall be our text and sermon both," exclaimed one colonial churchgoer. Led by Washington's example, the interrelationship between the free man and the soldier strengthened as the war went on. Give me liberty or give me death. Washington shuddered upon assuming command of the 30,000 troops surrounding Boston on July 3, 1775. He found fewer than 50 cannons and an ill-equipped, mixed multitude of people, comprising militia from New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Franklin actually suggested arming the military with bows and arrows. Although Washington theoretically commanded a total force of 300,000 scattered throughout the American colonies, in fact, he had a tiny actual combat force. Even the so-called regulars lacked discipline and equipment, despite bounties offered to attract soldiers and contributions from patriots to bolster the stores. Some willingly fought for what they saw as a righteous cause or for what they took as a threat to their homes and families, but others complained that they were fed with promises or clothed with filthy rags. Scarce materials drove up costs for the army and detracted from an efficient collection and distribution of goods, a malady that plagued the colonial armies until the end of the war. Prices paid for goods and labor in industry always exceeded those that the Continental Congress could offer, and beyond its abilities to raise in taxation, making it especially difficult to obtain troops. Nevertheless, the regular units provided the only stable body under Washington's command during the conflict, even as they came and went routinely because of the expiration of enlistment terms. Against the ragtag forces mustered by the colonies, Great Britain pitted a military machine that had recently defeated the French and Spanish armies, supplied and transported by the largest, best trained, and most lavishly supplied navy on earth. Britain also benefited from numerous established forts and outposts, a colonial population that in part remained loyal, and the absence of immediate European rivals who could drain time, attention, or resources from the war in America. In addition, the British had an able war commander in the person of General William Howe, and several experienced officers, such as Major General John Burgoyne and Lord Cornwallis. Nevertheless, English forces faced a number of serious, if unapparent, obstacles when it came to conducting campaigns in America. First and foremost, the British had to operate almost exclusively in hostile territory. That had not encumbered them during the French and Indian War, so many officers reasoned it would not present a problem in this conflict. But in the French and Indian War, the British had the support of most of the local population, whereas now, English movements were usually reported by patriots to American forces, and militias could harass them at will on the march. Second, command of the sea made little difference in the outcome of battles in interior areas. Worse, the vast barrier posed by the Atlantic made resupply and reinforcement by sea precarious, costly, and uncertain. Communications also hampered the British. Submitting a question to the High Command in England might entail a 3-month turnaround time, contingent upon good weather. Third, no single port city offered a strategic center from which British forces could deploy. At one time, the British had 6 armies in the colonies, yet they never managed to bring their forces together in a single overwhelming campaign. They had to conduct operations through a wide expanse of territory along a number of fronts involving seasonal changes from snow in New Hampshire to torrid heat in the Carolinas, all while searching for rebels who disappeared into mountains, forests, or local towns. Fourth, British officers, though capable in European-style war, never adapted to fighting a frontier rebellion against another Western-style army that had already adjusted to the new battlefield. Competent leaders such as Howe made critical mistakes, while less talented officers like Burgoyne bungled completely. At the same time, Washington slowly developed aggressive officers like Nathaniel Greene, Ethan Allen, and, before his traitorous actions, Benedict Arnold. Fifth, England hoped that the Iroquois would join them as allies, and that, conversely, the colonists would be deprived of any assistance from the European powers. Both hopes were dashed. The Iroquois Confederacy declared neutrality in 1776, and many other tribes agreed to neutrality soon thereafter as a result of efforts by Washington's able emissaries to the Indians. A few tribes fought for the British, particularly the Seneca and Cayuga, but 2 of the Iroquois Confederacy tribes actively supported the Americans, and the Onondaga divided their loyalties. As for keeping the European nations out, the British succeeded in officially isolating America only for a short time before scores of European freedom fighters poured into the colonies. Casimir Pulaski of Poland and the Marquis de Lafayette of France made exemplary contributions. Thaddeus Kosciuszko, another Pole, organized the defenses of Saratoga and West Point. And Baron von Steuben, a Prussian captain, drilled the troops at Valley Forge, receiving an informal promotion from Benjamin Franklin to general. Von Steuben's presence underscored a reality that England had overlooked in the conflict, namely that this would not be a battle against common natives who happened to be well-armed. Quite the contrary, it would pit Europeans against their own. British success in overcoming native forces had been achieved by discipline, drill, and most of all, the willingness of essentially free men to submit to military structures and utilize European close-order, mass-fire techniques. In America, however, the British armies encountered Continentals who fought with the same discipline and drill as they did, and who were as immersed in the same rights of Englishmen ideology that the British soldiers themselves had grown up with. It was thus a mistake to view Lexington and Concord, with their pitiable shot-to-kill ratio, as constituting the style of war. Rather, Saratoga and Cowpens reflected the essence of massed formations and shock combat, with the victor usually enjoying the better ground or generalship. Worth noting also is the fact that Washington's first genuine victory came over mercenary troops at Trenton, not over English redcoats, though that too would come. Even that instance underscored the superiority of free soldiers over indentured troops of any kind. Sixth, Great Britain's commanders in the field each operated independently, and each from a distance of several thousand miles from their true command center, Whitehall. No British officer in the American colonies had authority over the entire effort, and ministerial interventions often reflected not only the woefully outdated appraisals of the situation because of the delay in reporting intelligence, but also the internal politics that afflicted the British Army until well after the Crimean War. Finally, of course, France decisively entered the fray in 1778, sensing that, in fact, the young nation might actually survive, and offering the French a means to weaken Britain by slicing away the North American colonies from her control and providing sweet revenge for France's humiliating defeat in the Seven Years' War. The French fleet, under Admiral François-Joseph de Grasse, lured away the Royal Navy, which secured Cornwallis's flanks at Yorktown, winning at Sandy Hook one of the few great French naval victories over England. Without the protection of the Navy's guns, Yorktown fell. There is little question that the weight of the French forces tipped the balance in favor of the Americans, but even had France stood aside, the British proved incapable of pinning down Washington's army, and despite several victories, had not broken the will of the colonists. Opening campaigns. Immediately before Washington took command, the first significant battle of the conflict occurred at Breed's Hill. Patriot forces under General Israel Putnam and Colonel William Prescott had occupied the bluffs by mistake, intending instead to occupy Bunker Hill. The position overlooked the port of Boston, permitting the rebels to challenge ships entering or leaving the port, and even allowing the Americans to shell the city itself if they so desired. William Howe led a force of British troops in successive assaults up the hill. Although the Redcoats eventually took Breed's Hill when the Americans ran out of ammunition, the cost proportionately to the British was enormous. Almost half the British troops were either killed or wounded, and an exceptional number of officers died, 12% of all British officers killed during the entire war. England occupied the Heights and held Boston, but even that success proved transitory. In May 1775, Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold seized Fort Ticonderoga in New York from the British. Henry Knox and his men then began the tedious hauling of the fort's cannons to Dorchester Heights overlooking Boston, a difficult process of dragging the guns on sleds over 230 miles through heavy winter ice. With Knox's cannons in place on the heights, Washington could cut the British supply line, forcing them to evacuate on St. Patrick's Day, taking 1,000 Tories or Loyalists with them to Halifax, Nova Scotia. Only 2 weeks before, in North Carolina, Patriot forces had defeated a body of Tories, the Royal Governor's Highlander Scots, and in June, a British assault on Charleston was repulsed by 600 militiamen protected by a Palmetto Wood Fort Sullivan. While besieging Boston in the fall of 1775, Washington's army went on the offensive by way of a two-pronged invasion of Canada. Richard Montgomery led a force across Lake Champlain and through Montreal, while Benedict Arnold took an expedition through the woods of northern Maine to assault Quebec from the rear. Arnold's 1,100-man force soon dwindled to only 600 half-starved and nearly naked men. Outnumbered by the Quebec garrison, Arnold had to await Montgomery. They finally attacked on the last day of 1775, because the New York militiamen's enlistments were up and they had threatened to leave. To their credit, the militia adhered to the terms of their December 31st discharge and fought. Montgomery was felled immediately and Arnold wounded. The bulk of the American army was trapped and forced to surrender. Even in defeat, Arnold staged a stubborn retreat that prevented British units under General Guy Carleton from linking up with General Howe in New York. Unfortunately, although Washington appreciated Arnold's valor, few others did. Arnold's theater commanders considered him a spendthrift and even held him under arrest for a short time, leading the hero of many of America's early battles to become bitter and vengeful to the point of his eventual treason. Gradually, even the laissez-faire American armies came to appreciate the value of discipline, drill, and long-term commitment, bolstered by changing enlistment terms and larger cash bonuses for signing up. It marked a slow but critical replacement of revolutionary zeal with proven military practices and an appreciation for the necessity of a trained army in time of war. While the Northern campaign unfolded, British reinforcements arrived in Halifax, enabling Howe to launch a strike against New York City with more than 30,000 British and German troops. His forces landed on Staten Island on July 2nd, the day Congress declared independence. Supported by his brother, Admiral Lord Howe, General Howe drove out Washington's ill-fed and poorly equipped army, captured Long Island, and again threatened Washington's main force. Confronted with a military disaster, Washington withdrew his men across the East River into Manhattan. Howe missed an opportunity to capture the remainder of Washington's troops, but he had control of New York. Loyalists flocked to the city, which became a haven for Tories throughout the war. Washington had no alternative but to withdraw through New Jersey and across the Delaware River, in the process collecting or destroying all small vessels to prevent the British from following easily. At that point, the entire revolution might have collapsed under a less capable leader. He had only 3,000 men left of his army of 18,000, and the Patriot forces desperately needed a victory. In the turning point of the war, Washington not only rallied his forces, but staged a bold counterattack, recrossing the Delaware on Christmas night 1776 against a British army made up of Hessian mercenaries at Trenton. The difficulty of passing the river in a very severe night and their march through a violent storm of snow and hail did not in the least abate the troops' ardor. But when they came to the charge, each seemed to vie with the other in pressing forward, Washington wrote. At the cost of only 3 casualties, the Patriots netted over 900 Hessian prisoners. Washington then hastily retreated back 9 miles and crossed the Delaware again in freezing cold. The attack was extraordinary in every way. Washington then waited for Cornwallis on the south side of Trenton, lulling him into thinking the Continental Army was trapped. But he then marched around the British at night and slammed into Cornwallis's rear positions at Princeton, where he dealt the British another blow in early January 1777. There, the general rode between the British and American lines, about 75 yards apart, and called to his troops, "Parade with us, my brave fellows. We will have them directly." The British fired a full volley, but missed Washington and his horse. Washington, who normally was reserved in his comments about his troops, proudly informed Congress that the officers and men who were engaged in the enterprise behaved with great firmness, poise, advance, and bravery, and such as did them highest honor. Despite the fact that large British armies remained in the field, in 2 daring battles, Washington regained all the momentum lost in New York and sent a shocking message to the befuddled British that, indeed, they were in a war after all. Common Sense and the Declaration of Independence. As Washington's ragtag army tied up British forces, feelings for independence grew more intense. The movement awaited only a spokesman who could galvanize public opinion around resistance against the king. How unlikely, then, was the figure that emerged? Thomas Paine had come to America just over a year before he wrote Common Sense, arriving as a failure in almost everything he attempted in life. He wrecked his first marriage, and his second wife paid him to leave. He destroyed two businesses, one as a tobacconist and one as a corset maker, and flopped as a tax collector. But Paine had fire in his blood and defiance in his pen. In January 1776, he wrote his 50-page political tract, Common Sense, but his The American Crisis, published 11 months later during the darkest time of the Revolution, began with some of the most memorable lines in history. "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country." Eager readers did not shrink from the book, which quickly sold more than 100,000 copies. Paine sold close to 500,000 copies prior to 1800, which was the equivalent of selling 12 million today, meaning that one in six American homes had seen Common Sense. He could have been a wealthy man if he hadn't donated every cent he earned to the Revolution. Common Sense provided the prelude to Jefferson's Declaration of Independence that appeared in July 1776. Paine argued that the time for loyalty to the king had ended. "The blood of the slain, the weeping voice of nature, cries, 'Tis time to part." He thus tapped into widespread public sentiment, evidenced by the petitions urging independence that poured into the Continental Congress. Many colonial delegates received instructions from home to support independence by May 1776. On May 15th, Virginia resolved in its convention to create a Declaration of Rights, a constitution, a federation, and foreign alliances, and in June it established a republican government, for all intents and purposes declaring its independence from England. Patrick Henry became governor. Virginia led the way, and when the state congressional delegations were sent to vote on independence, only Virginia's instructions were not conditional. The Commonwealth had already thrown down the gauntlet. In June, Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee introduced a resolution that, "These United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states." The statement so impressed John Adams that he wrote, "This day the Congress has passed the most important resolution ever taken in America." As the momentum toward separation with England grew, Congress appointed a committee to draft a statement announcing independence. Members included Adams, Franklin, Roger Sherman, Robert Livingston, and the chairman, Thomas Jefferson, to whom the privilege of writing the final draft fell. Jefferson wrote so eloquently and succinctly that Adams and Franklin made only a few alterations, including Franklin's self-evident phrase. Most of the changes had to do with adding references to God. Even so, the final document remains a testament to the skill of Jefferson in capturing the essence of American ideals. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," he wrote, "that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." It is worth noting that Jefferson recognized that humans were created by a supreme being, and that all rights existed only in that context. Further reiterating Locke, he wrote that, "To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government." Government was natural, not artificial, so that when one government disappeared, the citizenry needed to establish another. But it should be kept in mind that these self-evident rights constituted an escalating sequence of connected assertions that ended in revolution, appealing not only to God, but to English history and law. This distanced Jefferson from the writings of Hobbes, and even though he borrowed heavily from Locke, he had further backed away from the notion that the civil state was artificial. On the other hand, Jefferson, by arguing that men instituted governments, borrowed entirely from the Enlightenment proposition that government was a human creation in the first place. In short, the Declaration clearly illustrated the dual strains of Western thought that had emerged as predominant by the 1700s, a continuing reverence for the primacy of God in human affairs, and yet an increasing attraction to the notion that earthly systems depended on human intellect and action, even when all aspects of that philosophy were not fully embraced. Jefferson's original draft, however, contained censures on the English people that some in Congress found excessive, and revisions, despite John Adams's frequent defenses of Jefferson's words, excised those sentences. The most offensive was Jefferson's traditional Virginia account of American slavery's being the fault of England. But any criticism of slavery, no matter whose fault, also indicted the slave colonies and was not tolerated. After a bitter debate over these phrases and other editing that changed about half of the draft, Congress adopted the final declaration on July 4, 1776, after adopting a somewhat less refined version on July 2. 2 weeks later, Congress voted to have the statement engrossed on parchment and signed by the members, who either appeared in person on August 2 or later affixed their names, Hancock's being the largest since he, reportedly, wanted the king to be able to read it without his spectacles. Each one of the 56 signers knew that the act of signing the declaration made them traitors to the crown, and therefore the line in which the delegates mutually pledged to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor literally exposed these heroes to execution. By the end of the war, almost every one had lost his property. Many had lost wives and families to British guns or prisons, and several died penniless, having given all to the Revolution. North to Saratoga. Following his stunning surprise attack at Trenton and his subsequent victory at Princeton, Washington experienced defeats at Brandywine Creek and Germantown. In the second battle, the Americans nearly won, and only the timely arrival of reinforcements gave the British a victory. Washington again had to retreat, this time to winter quarters at Valley Forge near Philadelphia. What ensued was one of the darkest times for Washington and his army. While the British enjoyed warmth and food in one of America's richest cities, the Continentals suffered through a miserable winter, decimated by illness and starvation, eating soup made of burnt leaves and dirt. Washington deluged Congress with letters and appeals. "Soap, vinegar, and other articles allowed by Congress, we see none," he wrote. Few men had more than a shirt, and some none at all, and a number of men confined to hospitals for want of shoes. Gradually, the army obtained supplies and equipment, and in the Spartan environment, Washington fashioned a disciplined fighting force. Washington proved the glue that held the entire operation together. Consistent and unwavering, he maintained confidence in front of the men, all the while pouring a steady stream of requests for support to the Congress, which was not so much unreceptive as helpless. Its only real source of income was the confiscation of Tory properties, which hardly provided the kind of funds demanded by armies in the field. The printing of paper money, Continentals, had proven a disaster, and American commanders in the field had taken to issuing IOUs in return for food, animals, and other supplies. Yet in that frozen Pennsylvania hell, Washington hammered the Americans into a tough fighting force, while the British grew lazy and comfortable, especially in New York and Philadelphia. Franklin quipped that Howe did not take Philadelphia so much as Philadelphia had taken Howe. The policy of occupying and garrisoning strategic hamlets proved no more successful in the 1770s than it did just under 200 years later when the American army tried a similar strategy in Vietnam, and with much the same effect on the morale of the occupiers. Howe's was not the only British army engaging the Americans. General John Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne launched an invasion of the Mohawk Valley, where he was to be supported by a second British column coming from Oswego under Barry St. Ledger. A third British force under Howe was to join them by moving up the Hudson. The plan came apart rapidly in that Howe never moved north, and St. Ledger retreated in the face of Benedict Arnold and Nicholas Herkimer's forces. Further, the Indian allies of the British abandoned them, leaving Burgoyne in a single column with extended supply lines deep in enemy territory. Having forgotten the fate of Varus's Roman legions in the Teutoburg Forest centuries earlier, Burgoyne's wagons bore the general's fine china, best dress clothes, four-poster bed, and his mistress with all her personal belongings. His column's entourage included 400 women camp followers, some wives, many paid servants, some prostitutes. Whatever their intangible contributions to morale, they slowed Burgoyne's army to a crawl. After capturing Ticonderoga and scattering American forces at Hubbardton, the British suffered a serious reverse when a scavenging party ran into American forces at Bennington, Vermont, and were defeated. When news of the victory reached New England towns, militia flooded into General Horatio Gates's command. He had 12,000 militia and 5,000 regulars facing Burgoyne's 6,000 troops with their extended supply lines. Burgoyne sensed he had to break the colonial armies before he was surrounded or his overtaxed transport system collapsed, prompting him to launch two attacks at Freeman's Farm near Saratoga in September and October. The Patriots decisively won the second encounter, leaving Burgoyne to ponder escape or surrender. Still placing his faith in reinforcements that, unbeknownst to him, would not arrive, Burgoyne partied in Saratoga, drinking and cavorting with his mistress. On October 17th, facing total defeat and with his army hungry, stranded, and surrounded, Burgoyne surrendered his entire force as the band played Yankee Doodle. In this age of civility and warfare, the defeated British negotiated a convention rather than a capitulation, under terms that specified that men could return to Europe under parole. But after Burgoyne hesitated to supply a listing of all troops, Congress revoked the terms and Burgoyne's army spent the remainder of the war in American captivity. Burgoyne himself received free passage back to England. Trust the French. When spring arrived, the victory at Saratoga and the thousands of arms it brought to Washington's forces gave Americans a new resolve. The ramifications of Saratoga stretched far beyond the battlefields of North America, all the way to Europe, where the colonists had courted France as a potential ally since the outbreak of hostilities. France sensibly stayed out of the conflict until the Patriots proved they had a chance of surviving. After Saratoga, however, Louis XVI agreed to discreetly support the American Revolution with munitions and money. A number of factors accounted for the willingness of France to risk involvement.